Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. My name is Ed Newcomer. I'm the host of Nature's Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. This is episode one of season one, our very first episode, and we have a fantastic guest today. In fact, the first time I thought about doing this podcast, I knew immediately who my first guest was going to be, and I'm very happy to welcome Marie Palladini. Marie is a professor at California State University at Dominguez Hills in Carson, California, where we're coming to you from today. But for 29 years, she was a special agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So welcome, Marie. Thank you for being on our very first episode.
Hi, Ed. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes, I am very excited. And I think we should actually say right off the bat, how we know each other, because I think it's going to be really obvious to listeners pretty quickly that we're friends.
Yes, I think it will be.
So how do we know each other?
Okay, I can start with that very easily. So I was the senior resident agent in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service office in Torrance, California for a few years before I retired. And prior to that, I was the training officer. And I was fortunate enough to train new agents, which in an indirect way, I think, prepared me for my second career as a professor. I really enjoyed meeting the new agents and teaching them the law and the ropes and some investigative tricks. So when Ed Newcomer came to our office in Torrance over 20 years ago, he was a very eager new agent, and I was very happy to have him and train him. And I use the word training very loosely because he didn't need a lot of training. Ed had a background in the administration of justice. He had been a judge, an administrative judge, and he had also been to law school, obviously. So we had a common connection about the law and how to conduct investigations. And, which we're going to talk about today, he was very, very eager to work on undercover cases, which I had had an extensive background in. So I took him under my wing, and it went from there. So that's how we met. And like I said, it was over 20 years ago, and we've maintained a professional and personal friendship through those years.
Definitely. Yes. And so you were my training officer, but then you also became my boss.
That's
right. And when you say you were the senior resident agent for Southern California, I think we called him RACS then, resident agent in charge. You actually were in charge of all of Southern California. So you oversaw the LA office and our San Diego office as well, right?
Correct. All of Los Angeles, Southern California, the border between Mexico and California, where wildlife does cross. And then I actually, for a short period of time, was responsible for parts of the Central Valley, Fresno. But then that changed when we had a reorganization. But yes, I oversaw that, the agents and the wildlife inspectors who worked at the international port in Los Angeles and at the border.
So a huge geographical area and a huge population, border port, seaport, airport, you name it. You had a huge responsibility. You know, within the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Law Enforcement, I think Los Angeles has always been considered one of the busiest field offices in the country. So,
yes, the major cities with the import-export responsibility were always the busiest. Los Angeles, New York, and Miami come to mind as being the three busiest offices with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They had large staffs. They had more special agents than some of the posts. Some of the posts, for example, Missoula, Montana, had one special agent for the whole state.
Right.
So that's a little different area of responsibility for the supervisors as well as for the field agents.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I remember, and we'll talk about what is a special agent in just a second, but one of the things I remember when I came and started working with you is you were a working supervisor. Like, what I mean by that is you were one of the few supervisors I ever knew of that still insisted on working a case, at least one case, even while you were supervising this huge district. And I have to tell you, you know, I remember that every agent in our office was super excited to help you work on that case. That was Bobby Jin. And you have so many stories. I know you're going to be on this podcast more than once. But, you know, you really set the example because you worked while you were supervising. You still got out there and you did surveillance. You did interviews. You worked your own case in addition to supporting all of us. And that was a great leadership example.
Well, thank you, Ed. That's quite a compliment. But it's also somewhat of a reflection on my selfishness because I liked being a supervisor, but I loved being a criminal investigator. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to let go of some of the casework if I could still manage to have one, what I considered complex investigation, international investigation that was assigned to me. And I knew I had the staff of special agents to help me, but thank you for that. And I really think as a supervisor, it's not always possible, but I think it sends a leadership message that might be different from that supervisor who is really the administrator in the office more so than the hands-on. So it's a personality issue as well, but for me, that was the best way to quote-unquote train the new agents, maybe by example, do this or don't do this, you know, kind of the do as I say, not as I do thing sometimes. But I think it really, kept me in tune with what the field agents were doing. It made for great camaraderie.
Absolutely.
And that was where I say part of it was selfish as well, because I loved working with the agents in the field.
Absolutely. I identify that with that 100% because later, after you retired, the agent who took over as the resident agent charge was Aaron Dean. And as you know, I eventually became her deputy. So I was supervising as well. And like you, I kind of insisted on maintaining a caseload. I wanted to do my own cases because, number one, you're selfish and you want to do the work, right? Because you like it. And number two, it's the only way to really kind of stay up on what people are doing. And after you retired, there was a lot of pressure from more senior managers for the first line supervisors, the resident agents in charge, not to do casework. I mean, they were really discouraged from it and kind of almost scolded for doing it. So, for example, Erin, the person who took over after you left, she didn't feel like she could do it. She would get scolded. And I used to trick her. I used to trick her and say, I really need your help on this, Erin. I've got to have you out in the field to help me just to, because I knew she wanted to get out and I knew she, you know, she's a great agent. You wouldn't want to waste that talent.
Yeah, that's a good example. And there might have been some trickling down from management that supervisors shouldn't have caseloads, but I may have put those in the back of my brain somewhere and kind of forgot about them just to keep one case going. Not that I was a rebel, but I kind of like to do things my way when I believe they would have good results.
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah. And you had the seniority to pull that off because you had a career of 29 years, right?
Yes.
That's a phenomenal, you know, service to the American people. And you saw a lot and you experienced a lot in how the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service changed over the years, mm-hmm. how the law enforcement program grew and changed. So a lot of the people you worked for, the special agents in charge, had much less experience than you did.
That was, I guess, a plus for me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Gave you a little bit of the cred that allowed you to do what you wanted to do.
Right.
So in that regard, let's make sure our listeners understand what a special agent is for the Fish and Wildlife Service. So, you know, tell us about it. What is a Fish and Wildlife Special Agent?
So I guess I should start with what is Fish and Wildlife Service.
Yep, right.
I can do that very, very briefly. The United States Fish and Wildlife Service is an agency within the United States Department of Interior. And the Fish and Wildlife Service is responsible for managing domestic, when I say domestic, I mean species domestic to the United States. I don't mean cats and
native
things like
stuff,
that. Native species. So we have the Fish and Wildlife Service is responsible for enforcing the laws that relate to the species within the United States, but uniquely enough, also international species that live in Africa or species that live in Asia because of the Endangered Species Act and an international treaty that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service signed with, I don't know how many signature countries there are now.
You're talking about CITES.
Correct.
Which is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Fauna and Flora, et cetera. But it's CITES, C-I-T-E-S. That, I think the last time I checked, Marie, I think it's around 185 countries are signatories to that now.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
And basically, it's an agreement between the nations to regulate and control wildlife as it, so it's not commercialized, and so the species aren't depleted. So with that umbrella understanding of what Fish and Wildlife Service does, it does other things in research and biology, but in the Division of Law Enforcement, which is one of the divisions within Fish and Wildlife Service, there are a field of, there's a group of special agents and wildlife inspectors that are charged with enforcing the Endangered Species Act, the Lacey Act, and I don't know, 10 or 12 other statutes. Yeah. I don't remember.
I think it's in the 20s, actually.
It might
now,
be in the 20s now.
I so think
as
so.
You go back 29 years plus. But there are a lot of federal statutes that protect wildlife and that the special agents are responsible for investigating and enforcing any violations of those laws. So there's a very wide range of statutes that can protect migratory birds, endangered species that are native to the United States, things like the brown pelican or the bald eagle, which is no longer an endangered species thanks to work done through the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. But there's also international species like the rhinoceros, the tiger, that the special agents investigate. And depending where you're assigned, you might focus on, the special agent may in fact focus on cases that involve international commercialization of wildlife versus the special agent who may, as I said earlier, may be assigned to work in Montana, and that special agent might be working on wildlife hunting violations, wolf violations, things that are other species that are protected. So that's kind of a, I don't know, a schematic of what the job entails, but the special agent is like every other special agent in the federal government. And I say that because the special agent is hired in a series. Federal government has certain series where they describe a job, which is tasked with investigating and enforcing laws of that particular agency. So basically, I used to tell my kids when I would, and their friends when I would do presentations at their schools, basically, a Fish and Wildlife Special Agent is kind of like the FBI for animals.
Absolutely.
So it's an investigative position with authority to carry a firearm, to arrest, to conduct searches and seizures, present to the grand jury. So a description of a federal criminal investigator fits what a special agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife does.
Right. Sometimes in the trade, we called ourselves 1811s, right?
Yes.
Because that's that series you're talking about is a 1811. If you look in the federal personnel system, a GS 1811 is a special agent, regardless of what agency you work for.
That's right. That's exactly right. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, GS 1811, and it carries a lot of benefits as well.
Right.
One, I think, aspect of being a GS 1811 that maybe Ed and I weren't so thrilled about is there is a mandatory retirement after at a certain age.
Right.
I guess I could say it, 57.
57.
I guess at that age, the federal government decided that you couldn't jump over fences and kick in doors anymore. So they decided you have to retire at 57.
It's so funny you say that. I can't remember if you and I had this conversation before, but it's kind of true, right? You know, I remember when I first came on, you didn't miss a beat if somebody said, hey, if the gate's locked, we're going to jump the fence. But I do remember the last year or two, I was an agent and went on a raid with, you know, U.S. Marshals or our own agents. And at the briefing, they said, hey, if the gate's locked, you know, we're going to jump over. And then in my head, I thought, I'm not sure I'm going to. You guys might.
You guys might. You guys that aren't approaching 57 might.
Exactly.
Well, you know, I guess they maybe the decision makers who said that were wiser than we know.
Maybe so. So, an agent is a plainclothes investigator, you know, is your stereotypical Fed, right?
Exactly.
So let's talk now about your long career. I don't want to, you know, dime you out as far as your age is, but you were hired what year?
I was hired as a special agent in 1976.
And how old were you then?
Yeah, now 23.
Now everybody gets to know how old you are.
Yeah, I was very young, 23.
But it's important because you were young, and that's kind of unusual for federal agents in general to be hired straight out of college, right? You came on straight out of college.
Pretty much, yeah.
So how did you, as a young woman in the 70s, decide you wanted to be a special agent for Fish and Wildlife Service? How did that happen?
You know, that's an interesting question, Ed, because I I studied criminology when I was in college. My undergraduate degree was criminology. There was no criminal justice degree, and actually criminology was a new area in the 70s of specialization. Pretty much before that, I think it was sociology or political science. And so I studied criminology.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to school in Pennsylvania, Indiana University of Pennsylvania, small state school. Kind of a similar setup in Pennsylvania as California has with state universities and state colleges. Pennsylvania didn't have as many, of course, as California does, but it was a state school. And the we had adjunct faculty that taught policing and investigative work, which I really enjoyed. And when I studied criminology, I remember speaking with one of my professors and saying, I would like to be an investigator. I don't want to put on a uniform every day, but I like connecting the dots and figuring out what happens. I really want to catch the bad guys. Mm-hmm. And I learned that from some of the case studies we did in the classroom. So when I studied criminology, we were very fortunate at my school, just like I believe our students are here at Dominguez Hills. We had an internship program. So one summer between my junior and senior year, I was able to intern at, are you ready? The Pennsylvania Bureau of Investigations. PBI.
Like the state version of FBI. Like I think Colorado has a Bureau of Investigation. Georgia has one. I didn't know Pennsylvania had one.
Yeah.
But how does that lead you to the United States Fish and Wildlife Service?
So what happened was I got a bigger and better taste of investigations, and I was sure that's what I wanted to do.
Got it.
So when I graduated from school, I took a test with the federal government. I'm like, well, I'm going to go for it. I took a test. Back then, you have to take a test, and it was called the Treasury Enforcement Agent Exam. So I took that. I did very well on it. And then I just went to Washington, D.C., because I had a family member who lived there. And I thought, well, I'm going to look for a federal job, maybe U.S. Customs back then or DEA. So I was I actually got an interview. I was interviewing with the U.S. Customs Service. I'm pretty sure that's who it was, the predecessor to what we have under DHS now. And the person, she was interviewing me, the HR lady, and she said, you know, you have great credentials. You do have some experience from your internship. 3 months. She said, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is recruiting, and she said this, they're looking for women agents because they're trying to balance out their new concept of being criminal investigators rather than federal game management agent. So they had just gone through a restructuring where they were looking, meaning Fish and Wildlife Service, they were looking for criminal investigators versus game wardens that want to be federal agents. So they were trying to expand and do more criminal investigations, international cases. So I said, well, I don't really know much about them. So she told me about them. I researched and I was so excited because I don't know, this is really going back, but the very first Earth Day was when I was a senior in high school, and I started believing that I was becoming an environmentalist, but I didn't really take that with me to college. It was just kind of a concept, a way of life, where we're becoming more aware of pollution, of littering, of our air, and global warming, things that we didn't really know a lot about back then, but it was kind of an eye-opener for people that were, you know, in young, under 20s, high school kids. We had a little group where we went and picked up trash. So it was kind of, you know, predecessor to being an environmentalist, so to speak. So when she told me about U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I said, well, that sounds like something I would really be interested in because I grew up in Western PA. I spent time in the outdoors with my cousins. My family, just a little side note, my family and my cousin's family, we all kind of grew up together. Mm-hmm. And each one of my sisters had a cousin her age, but I was the only one that had a boy cousin my age.
Oh, okay.
So I used to hang out in the woods with him. Right. We'd run in the creeks. We'd play combat. We'd do all this stuff that kind of exposed me to the outdoors more than I probably would have with my sisters, so to speak. But I really enjoyed it. I mean, I guess is the best way to put it. Yeah. Did I ever think about being a game warden? Probably not.
Right.
But I really, really believed in the mission of the Fish and Wildlife Service when I learned about it. So that's what happened. I went for an interview at Fish and Wildlife after that wonderful lady referred me to them. And I got lucky because they were putting together a new class. And I waited a little bit, but it wasn't very long. It was probably within a year, and I got hired.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Timing is everything, right?
It is. It is.
And, you know, this is mid-70s, so law enforcement in general was a heavily male-dominated profession. Do you even know, like, what, how many other women before you had been hired to be special agents for Fish and Wildlife, specifically for Fish and Wildlife?
For Fish and Wildlife, when I was hired in 1976, I thought about this the other day, there were 4 women special agents that had been hired.
Wow, before you.
Before me, right. And I think when I actually started, there were 3. One of them quit. She didn't like it. So, so I was 1 of 4 at the time I got hired.
I imagine, and this is probably a topic for a whole other episode, is I can only imagine that there was probably some resistance among some of the men in the Fish and Wildlife Service about bringing on women.
Probably.
And it probably took some serious...
Yeah.
Courage to like stick it out and do it and be good at it.
Yeah. You know, it was a time period where, like you say, law enforcement in general, criminal investigations was pretty much male dominated.
Yeah.
The FBI hired its first woman agent in 1973.
So just a few years before.
So the other federal agencies started to follow, which is why, to her credit, the HR woman,
yeah,
I'm sure she told other people as well, that the focus right then was to try to diversify the force to get some women in.
Right.
And so that's what I did. And maybe she just happened to think I was a Fish and Wildlife kind of person. I don't know, but she sent me there, which was great.
Yeah, it certainly worked out. And, you know, the timing of it, as you mentioned, kind of that era, you know, Clean Water Act was signed during this time, became law. The Endangered Species Act became law. So there was kind of this environmental wake-up call in the United States. I remember as a kid, I think it was early 70s, you know, there was a river in Ohio that caught on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, I think it's the Cuyahoga.
One of those, yes.
But yeah, I remember that really vividly, seeing that on news. And in my little, you know, young person's brain, I'm like, how can a river be on fire? And I think that was indicative of the damage that our country had done to its environment. And so anyway, that kind of leads me to the next thing, because Endangered Species Act enacted in 1973 in the form that we know it today. And one of the first species listed, among the first species listed, was the American alligator.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about alligators today, because one of your very first really cases of significance involved American alligators, which I don't think most people even think about today, because they're pretty common now.
Yes.
They're still, interestingly, I checked on this before I came here today, they're still listed as threatened, but it's not because they're actually in danger. So the way the Endangered Species Act work, as you know, but just for our listeners, if an animal is listed under the ESA as endangered, it means it is at immediate risk of becoming extinct. If it's listed as threatened, it means it's at risk of becoming endangered. So there's kind of these different levels of protection. But as far as the law goes, the prohibitions about what you can do to an endangered or threatened animal are the same. It's just the penalties that vary. But anyway, alligators are still listed as threatened, which surprised me. But it turns out the reason why is because they have such a similar appearance to the American crocodile, which is endangered and at risk of extinction. So by keeping them on the endangered species list as threatened now, it gives them, it gives enforcement and the government an opportunity to extend protections to the crocodile, which I never thought of that. And I was an agent. And
yeah. Similarity of appearance. Yeah, I remember reading that in the regulations.
Yeah. So, but back in, tell us what was the situation with the American alligator when you became an agent?
Well, when I became an agent, the American alligator was listed as endangered. Mm. And what had happened historically, so this was in the 70s, you know, maybe 20, 30 years before that, was the American alligator had been hunted and the skins had been sent overseas. And it was a very much a fashion commodity, which it still is today, but it's handled way differently now. But during that time period, people were wearing alligator boots, alligator belts, women had handbags. So it was a very popular commodity to have in the leather industry.
All over the world, right?
All over the world. And basically, you know, from the United States alligator population to the skins being sent to France and Italy and Japan, even to be made into clothing materials or anyway, apparel, the apparel industry. So it was very popular. And also, you got to think about where alligators live. So they live in the, their habitat is in Louisiana and Florida, and there was a population in Louisiana of, I would say, poachers, for lack of a better word, who could make some money from actually killing alligators and selling the skins. And that's kind of what was happening when I became a new agent, the awareness of the extent of the demise of the alligator from the poaching came to the forefront of the Fish and Wildlife Service. Mm-hmm. So they had started investigations into, well, who's actually poaching these? How is this network working?
Right.
So remember, as I said earlier, in 1974, maybe 73, I'm not sure the exact year, a couple of years before I was hired, the focus of Fish and Wildlife expanded from game management agent to criminal investigator. So this was an opportunity to actually conduct an investigation into commercialization of right. one of our species that right. lived in the United States and an international, I guess, conglomerate of smugglers, poachers, an enterprise, a money-making operation, which, Ed, you know, Ed, and we know throughout the years, that's really usually the root of all these yes. cases that we investigate is about money. So.
Yeah, and it takes on this extra level or layer of importance because we are not talking about some good old boys who are going out and shooting a few alligators for fun, you know, the classic poacher. What we're talking about are people who are involved in a fairly complex mm-hmm. criminal enterprise that's ongoing with multiple layers. So you've got the poachers who are then selling to distributors who are then selling on to the next level, ultimately to people who are shipping them overseas. And so it becomes, that's how that can really cause a threat to an entire species, right? Because exactly. once that commercialization kicks in, mm-hmm. Can wipe them out, right?
Yes.
So
and it almost did a couple of our other species. So
yes, you know, it's not happen. It's yeah. not limited to the yeah. American alligator, and it still goes on today. You mm-hmm. know, yes. you know the Totuaba fish in Mexico. The you know sea cucumbers are under threat now. Yeah. Native tortoises and turtles in the southeast are yes. now under threat. So yeah, it can be a problem. But and it's interesting because certainly. All of the biologists of the Fish and Wildlife Service and the state agencies deserve, you know, much credit for the recovery of the American alligator or the bald eagle or whatever. But I think the unsung heroes of species preservation and protection and recovery are law enforcement, because when someone like you gets involved and does a good case and takes out some of these people who were involved in these mm-hmm. ongoing criminal enterprises, it gives the species breathing room, right? It gives them a chance to recover and for the biologists to do their job. And a lot of times I don't think people realize the role law enforcement plays in not just protecting, but recovering species who are about to become extinct.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think probably it's the nature of law enforcement culture itself too.
Yeah.
Law enforcement agents, special agents, investigators do their job, want to make sure that the bad guy, for lack of a better description, and the whole chain of bad guys are taken down and then move on to the next species or the
exactly.
next case.
Exactly.
The recovery just kind of comes with it, which is great. And that's an interesting point, too, because one of the nice things about working in the Fish and Wildlife Service was the collaboration mm-hmm. between the criminal investigators and the biologists mm-hmm. and the research entity to save species, pretty
right.
much.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
and their habitat.
Exactly. But I think you're right. I think agents, I certainly didn't walk around thinking I was saving species, right? Mm-hmm. I think the best agents are cops first. Right.
Yeah, well, we're a little biased, but yes.
They don't like criminals, period, yeah, right. right? And if they weren't a Fish and Wildlife agent, they'd be some other sort of cop.
Exactly.
You know, your example's the perfect example.
Yeah.
You were interested in law enforcement, but within law enforcement, Fish and Wildlife was attractive to you. That was exactly the same for me.
How lucky were we?
Totally.
I mean, think about being a law enforcement person or criminal investigator in another agency. It would have been fine, but mm-hmm. the reward of mm-hmm. actually thinking that you're making the world a better place. And you are with other types of crime as well. But just from nature, I mean, you know, step outside one day, and well, maybe not now, but in certain times in our history, and just look outside, go to a national park, just appreciate nature.
Exactly.
And I think worldwide, we have a really small impact on that, and small is better than none.
Yeah. And I think sometimes it's bigger than we think it is.
Yeah.
I think, you know, a lot of the world looks to us because we do have the Endangered Species Act. We do protect species that are not native to the United States, as well as native species. And I think a lot of the world does look to us as a leader in law enforcement for wildlife. So let's get back to alligators now. So we've got this situation now in the mid 70s where alligators populations are crashing in part because of like unchecked poaching and this commercial pressure. So how do you get involved in this? you not only were you hired as a young person to become an agent, but pretty quickly you got recruited to go into the Special Operations Unit, SOU, didn't you?
Correct.
Yeah. Tell us what SOU is.
Okay, so SOU stands for Special Operations Unit. And when I applied for the job as a special agent, I told the interviewers, and I don't know why, but I did. I think I had part of my research. I basically said that I wanted to work undercover. I told them that. But I said I would be assigned wherever they were going to send me because I wanted the job so badly. So before I went to the academy, I did not know where I was going to be assigned. And then while we were at the academy, I was lucky. I got assigned to Washington, D.C., and in the SOU unit, so Special Operations Unit, which at that time was very small. I think there were four or five special agents working only undercover. And just a little piece about that unit, I don't know how much it's changed since then.
A lot.
But those particular agents were based in headquarters, but they were giving assignments all over the country.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, we'll do the alligator, but just to give one example, let's say that we had information that somebody maybe was selling illegal walrus ivory that had come from Alaska and was being sold internationally or in interstate commerce. I may have been called to go to be a buyer for that ivory. So it depended on the niche and that type of thing, you know, versus maybe there was a hunting operation that needed somebody to go in and just get some intelligence on what they're doing because there was information that they were poaching and selling parts of bears or something. So maybe I would go in on that with another agent. So it just depended. Yeah. The field agents in those regions did it as well, but sometimes there were more long-term cases where the undercover agents would do it. So I wanted to do that, and I think I know this now. I don't think I knew that then, what I'm going to say. I think part of the reason that it was so attractive to me is I believed it would be easier than knocking on doors
You're
and
so
saying,
foolish.
I have a warrant for your arrest and looking up at the person versus here I am. I don't know anything about alligators. Will you tell me about them? So to me, it was an easier segue from being a college kid to being a professional.
I did. So you said that looking up at somebody and saying, we do have to point out, how tall are you?
5'1" on a good day.
Right. So diminutive frame. Yes.
Yeah. That's what happened. So I told them I wanted to do that. And I was very enamored by what the undercover agents were doing because I knew about it. And I learned more about it at the academy.
Uh-huh.
So what happens is, the Fish and Wildlife Service have the leaders of each region. They're called the special agents in charge. And back then there were 8 regions. So every year, twice a year, the special agent in charge, the SAC, they would have this meeting. So they had a meeting right around the time I got out of the academy, and it happened to be in Washington, D.C., where I was stationed. And they had the meeting, and they were talking about, one of the things on the agenda was, we have to do something about this operation that's going on where alligators are being poached, the poachers are being paid, they're couriering them to different places in the country, and they're being shipped overseas.
Okay.
And hark, we have an informant named AJ Cairo from Louisiana who is coming forward. We busted him before. He wants to help us because he has a vendetta against one of the couriers.
Uh-huh.
And so they sat around the table, and Dave Hall, who was the special agent in charge in New Orleans at the time in Louisiana, said, well, we just have a bunch of new agents that come out of the academy, and we need to send AJ in with his girlfriend, because he usually brought a friend with him when he brought the skins to New York, which is what he was doing. And why don't we have Marie Palladini go with him because she fits the role, whatever that was.
Right. Right. The role might have been just you were a woman.
Right. I think that's what it was.
Which is actually a deadly set of skills to have. Yes. To have that as your gender doing undercover work, you're often not suspected.
Because there were a couple hundred other people that couldn't have done it, right?
Right, right.
So that's what happened. And I guess from what Dave Hall, who believed in me, told me after, he got a lot of pushback around the table.
Interesting.
Yeah. She's new. She doesn't know anything. Right. What if something happens? This is dangerous. Because they were, you know, they were career criminals. These were not people that were just, you know, like you said earlier, poach one alligator and sell it.
Yep.
I mean, there were thousands of alligators being transported between the bayou in Louisiana to this particular case to the middleman, a guy named Jack Kelly in New York.
Wow. Okay.
And then Jack Kelly worked with the, I guess, the larger entity, the corporation, a guy named Jack Klappish, who actually owned a leather business. And they were sending the alligator skins in with other leathers over to Japan and France to be made into products.
So I imagine this broader SOU investigation was targeting those guys, right?
Correct.
Yeah, because they want to take out the higher level and kill the whole operation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And apparently the intelligence they had was that Kelly and or one of his colleagues would drive down to Louisiana, pick up skins, and then take them back up to New York and then ship them out of New Jersey.
I see.
Out of the terminal there. And sometimes AJ, the informant, would drive them up himself with a friend, usually a girlfriend, and they would drive from New Orleans, which is 1,500 miles from New Jersey all the way up to New York, carrying stinky alligator skins up to New Jersey and then ship them out of the country and meet with Kelly, and AJ would get paid. And interestingly enough, alligators, I don't know how long they are now. They might be bigger now, but they would range about 5 feet in length.
Okay, smaller.
Yeah, and AJ would take them, skin them out, and salt the hides, and then measure them, and the price would be about $40 to $50 per linear foot.
Wow.
So AJ stood to make a decent amount of money, and then at each stage along the way, of course, the price goes up.
Yep.
So it was a worthwhile venture, I guess, for somebody that lived in the bayou and knew alligators and, you know, had a kind of a poaching lifestyle. So
yeah, I mean, you know, those are the people they're recruited because they have the skill set to go get the animal, right? And then as the skill set gets more sophisticated moving up in terms of finding buyers and how to ship and how to smuggle, the price goes up. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And AJ had a bad situation happen one time when he brought the skins to Kelly. Kelly was a, probably still is. I don't know.
Kelly's the guy in New York, right?
Kelly is the middleman in New York that I was assigned to work with AJ to actually get enough information as an undercover agent that of his operation and how they were sending the skins overseas.
Got it. Yeah. So
buying, repackaging, and sending.
Okay.
Kelly was the kind of guy, he was kind of a, I don't know, hoodlum, so to speak. And he basically upset AJ on one of the trips because AJ brought his quote unquote girlfriend with him, not me, before I went.
Right.
And something happened to the girl when AJ was not in the room or was away doing something involving either Kelly putting something in her drink or taking advantage of her, and she was very upset. So that's where AJ decided he wanted to, quote unquote, get Kelly. So that was the impetus for him to set him up with Fish and Wildlife.
That was the vendetta you referenced.
Exactly.
Classic, right?
Yeah.
Inevitably, in a human relationship, somebody's going to get pissed off at somebody else. And that person who gets pissed off if you're into criminal activity, you don't want a friend who's pissed off at you because turn on you.
But why would you put in another woman?
Well, what do you mean? Why would you put in another woman?
Well, let's put something in her drink.
Yeah.
It's a little risky.
It was, super risky. And we're going to talk about that because we're running out of time. So we're going to break it into two episodes and pick this up next week. Please connect with us online. We've got a website, which is naturesecretservice.com. If you go there, you can leave a comment. You can drop us a question that we'll try to answer in a future episode. We also have a Facebook and Instagram account. So please follow us. And remember, this is our first episode. So if you make comments about us, be nice. We will see you next time. Nature Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturesecretservice.com.